Side 2. The Bachman Books. 4 Early Novels. Continuing with Rage on page 37. I had to. I know that's hard to understand, but I had to. It came down to that. And Mr. Vance. But I want everyone here to take it easy. No one is going to shoot the place up, so you don't have to worry. Carol Granger raised her hand timidly. I nodded at her. She was smart, smart as a whip. Class president and a cinch to speak a piece as valedictorian in June. Our responsibilities to the black race, or maybe hopes for the future. She was already signed up for one of those big league women's colleges where people always wonder how many virgins there are, but I didn't hold it against her. When can we go, Charlie? I sighed and shrugged my shoulders. We'll just have to wait and see what happens. But my mother will be worried to death. Why? Sylvia Reagan asked. She knows where you are, doesn't she? General laugh. Except for Ted Jones. He wasn't laughing. And I was going to have to watch that boy. He was still smiling his small, savage smile. He wanted badly to blow everything out of the water, obvious enough. But why? Insanity prevention merit badge? Not enough. Adulation of the community in general? The boy who stood on the burning deck with his finger in the dike? It didn't seem his style. Handsome low profile was Ted's style. He was the only guy I knew who had quit the football team after 3 Saturdays of glory in his junior year. The guy who wrote sports for the local rag had called him the best running back Placerville High School had ever produced. But he had quit, suddenly and with no explanation. Amazing enough. What was more amazing was the fact that his popularity quotient hadn't lost a point. If anything, Ted became more the local BMOC than ever. Joe McKennedy, who had suffered through 4 years and 1 broken nose at left tackle, told me that the only thing Ted would say when the agonized coach demanded an explanation was that football seemed to be a pretty stupid game, and he, Ted, thought that he could find a better way to spend his time. You can see why I respected him, but I was damned if I knew why he wanted me in such a personal way. A little thought on the matter might have helped, but things were going awful fast. Are you nuts? Harmon Jackson asked suddenly. I think I must be, I said. Anyone who kills anyone else is nuts in my book. Well, maybe you ought to give yourself up, Harmon said. Get some help, a doctor, you know. You mean like that Grace? Sylvia asked. My God, that creepster. I had to go see him after I threw an inkwell at old Lady Green. All he did was look up my dress and try to get me to talk about my sex life. Not that you've had any, Pat Fitzgerald said, and there was another laugh. And not that it's any business of his or yours, she said haughtily, dropped her cigarette on the floor and mashed it. So, what are we going to do? Jack Goldman asked. Just get it on, I said. That's all. Out on the lawn, a second town police car had arrived. I guessed that the third one was probably down at Junior's Diner, taking on vital shipments of coffee and donuts. Denver was talking with a state trooper in blue pants and one of those almost Stetsons they wear. Up on the road, Jerry Kesserling was letting a few cars through the roadblock to pick up kids who didn't ride the bus. The cars picked up and then drove hastily away. Mr. Grace was talking to a guy in a business suit that I didn't know. The firemen were standing around and smoking cigarettes and waiting for someone to tell them to put out a fire or go home. "Has this got anything to do with you beating up Carlson?" Corky asked. "How should I know what it has to do with?" I asked him irritably. If I knew what was making me do it, I probably wouldn't have to. It's your parents. Susan Brooks spoke up suddenly. It must be your parents. Ted Jones made a rude noise. I looked over at her, surprised. Susan Brooks was one of those girls who never say anything unless called upon, the ones that teachers always have to ask to speak up, please. A very studious, very serious girl. A rather pretty but not terribly bright girl. The kind who isn't allowed to give up and take the general or the commercial courses, because she had a terribly bright older brother or older sister, and teachers expect comparable things from her. In fine, one of those girls who are holding the dirty end of the stick with as much good grace and manners as they can muster. Usually they marry truck drivers and move to the West Coast, where they have kitchen nooks with formica counters, and they write letters to the folks back east as seldom as they can get away with. They make quiet, successful lives for themselves and grow prettier as the shadow of the bright older brother or sister falls away from them. My parents, I said, tasting it. I thought about telling them I had been hunting with my dad when I was 9. My Hunting Trip by Charles Decker. Subtitle, or How I Overheard My Dad Explain the Cherokee Nose Job. Too revolting. I snatched a look at Ted Jones, and the rich, coppery aroma of pay dirt filled my nostrils. His face was set in a furious, jeering expression, as if someone had just forced a whole lemon into his mouth and then jammed his jaws together, as if someone had dropped a depth charge into his brains and sent some old sunken hulk into long and ominous psychic vibrations. "That's what it says in all the psychology books," Susan was going on, all blithely unaware. In fact, she suddenly became aware of the fact that she was speaking, and in a normal tone of voice, and in class, and clammed up. She was wearing a pale jade-colored blouse, and her bra straps showed through like ghostly, half-erased chalk marks. "My parents," I said again, and stopped again. I remembered the hunting trip again, but this time I remembered waking up, seeing the moving branches on the tight canvas of the tent. Was the canvas tight? You bet it was. My dad put that tent up, and everything he did was tight. No loose screws there. Looking at the moving branches, needing to whiz, feeling like a little kid again, and remembering something that had happened long ago. I didn't want to talk about that. I hadn't talked about it with Mr. Grace. This was getting it on for real. And besides, there was Ted. Ted didn't care for this at all. Perhaps it was all very important to him. Perhaps Ted could still be helped. I suspected it was much too late for me. But even on that level, don't they say that learning is a good and elegant thing for its own sake? Sure. Outside, nothing much seemed to be going on. The last town police car had arrived, and just as I had expected, they were handing out coffee and... Story time, chillens. My parents, I said. Chapter 14. My parents met at a wedding reception, and although it may have nothing to do with anything, unless you believe in omens, the bride that day was burned to death less than a year later. Her name was Jessie Decker Hannaford. As Jessie Decker, she had been my mom's roommate at the University of Maine, where they were both majoring in political science. The thing that seemed to have happened was this. Jessie's husband went out to a special town meeting, and Jessie went into the bathroom to take a shower. She fell down and hit her head and knocked herself unconscious. In the kitchen, a dish towel fell on a hot stove burner. The house went up like a rocket. Wasn't it a mercy she didn't suffer? So the only good thing that came out of that wedding was my mother's meeting with Jessie Decker Hannaford's brother. He was an ensign in the Navy. After the reception, he asked my mother if she would like to go dancing. She said yes. They courted for 6 months, and then they were married. I came along about 14 months after the nuptials, and I've done the math again and again. As near as I can figure, I was conceived on one of the nights just before or just after my father's sister was being broiled alive in her shower cap. She was my mom's bridesmaid. I've looked at all the wedding pictures, and no matter how often I've looked, it always gives me a weird feeling. There is Jessie holding my mother's bridal train. Jessie and her husband, Brian Hannaford, smiling in the background as my mom and dad cut the wedding cake. Jessie dancing with the minister. And in all the pictures, she is only 5 months away from the shower and the dish rag on the hot stove burner. You wish you could step into one of those Kodachromes and approach her, say, "You're never going to be my Aunt Jessie unless you stay out of the shower when your husband is away. Be careful, Aunt Jessie." But you can't go back. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost and all that. But it happened, which is another way of saying I happened, and that's it. I was an only child. My mother never wanted another. She's very intellectual, my mother. Reads English mysteries, but never by Agatha Christie. Victor Canning and Hammond Innes were always more her cup of tea. Also magazines like the Manchester Guardian and Monocle and the New York Review of Books. My father, who made a career of the Navy and ended up as a recruiter, was more the all-American type. He likes the Detroit Tigers and the Detroit Red Wings and wore a black armband the day Vince Lombardi died. No shit. And he reads those Richard Stark novels about Parker the thief. That always amused the hell out of my mother. She finally broke down and told him that Richard Stark was really Donald Westlake, who writes sort of funny mysteries under his real name. My father tried one and hated it. After that, he always acted like Westlake Stark was his private lapdog who turned against him one night and tried to bite his throat. My earliest memory is of waking up in the dark and thinking I was dead until I saw the shadows moving on the walls and the ceiling. There was a big old elm outside my window, and the wind would move the branches. This particular night, The first night I remember anything, there must have been a full moon. Hunter's moon, do they call it? Because the walls were very bright and the shadows were very dark. The branch shadows looked like great moving fingers. Now when I think of it, they seem like corpse fingers. But I couldn't have thought that then, could I? I was only three. A kid that little doesn't even know what a corpse is. But there was something coming. I could hear it down the hall. Something terrible was coming. Coming for me through the darkness. I could hear it creaking and creaking and creaking. I couldn't move. Maybe I didn't even want to move. I don't remember about that. I just lay and watched the tree fingers move on the wall and ceiling and waited for the creaking thing to get down to my room and throw open the door. After a long time, it might have been an hour, or it might only have been seconds, I realized the creaking thing wasn't after me at all, or at least not yet. It was after Mom and Dad down the hall. The creaking thing was in Mom and Dad's room. I lay there watching the tree fingers and listened. Now the whole thing seems so dreamy and far away, like a city must look from a mountaintop where the air is rare but very real just the same. I can remember the wind shuffling back and forth against the glass of my bedroom window. I can remember wetting myself. It was warm and somehow comforting. And I can remember the creaking thing. After a long, long time, I can remember my mother's voice, out of breath and irritable and a little afraid. Stop now, Carl. Again the creaking, furtive. Stop it! A mutter from my father. From my mother. I don't care. I don't care if you didn't. Stop it and let me sleep. So I knew. I went to sleep, but I knew. The creaking thing was my father. Chapter 15. Nobody said anything. Some of them hadn't got the point, if there was one. I wasn't sure. They were still looking at me expectantly, as if awaiting the punchline of a rather good joke. Others were studying their hands, obviously embarrassed. But Susan Brooks looked altogether radiant and vindicated. It was a very nice thing to see. I felt like a farmer spreading shit and growing corn. Still, nobody said anything. The clock buzzed away with a vague kind of determination. I looked down at Mrs. Underwood. Her eyes were half open, glazed, gummy. She looked no more important than a woodchuck I had once blown away with my father's 410. A fly was unctuously washing its paws on her forearm. Feeling a little disgusted, I waved it away. Outside, four more police cars had arrived. Other cars were parked along the shoulder of the highway for as far as I could see beyond the roadblock. Quite a crowd was gathering. I sat back, dry-scrubbed the side of my face with my hand, and looked at Ted. He held up his fists to shoulder height, smiled, and popped up the middle fingers on each one. He didn't speak, but his lips moved, and I read it easily. Shit. Nobody knew it had been passed but him and me. He looked ready to speak aloud, but I wanted to just keep it between us for a little while. I said, Chapter 16. My dad has hated me for as long as I can remember. That's a pretty sweeping statement, and I know how phony it sounds. It sounds petulant and really fantastic. The kind of weapon kids always use when the old man won't come across with a car for your heavy date at the drive-in with Peggy Sue, or when he tells you that if you flunk world history the second time through, he's going to beat the living hell out of you. In this bright day and age, when everybody thinks psychology is God's gift to the poor old anally fixated human race, and even the President of the United States pops a trank before dinner, it's really a good way to get rid of those Old Testament guilts that keep creeping up our throats like the aftertaste of a bad meal we overate. If you say your father hated you as a kid, you can go out and flash the neighborhood, commit rape, or burn down the Knights of Pythias bingo parlor and still cop a plea. But it also means that no one will believe you if it's true. You're the little boy that cried wolf. And for me, it is true. Oh, nothing really stunning until after the Carlson thing. I don't think Dad himself really knew it until then. Even if you could dig to the very bottom of his motives, he'd probably say, at the most, that he was hating me for my own good. Metaphor time in the old corral. To Dad, life was like a precious antique car. Because it is both precious and irreplaceable, you keep it immaculate and in perfect running order. Once a year, you take it to the local old car show. No grease is ever allowed to foul the gasoline, no sludge to find its way into the carb, no bolt to loosen on the drive shaft. It must be tuned, oiled, and greased every 1,000 miles, and you have to wax it every Sunday just before the pro game on TV. My dad's motto? Keep it tight and keep it right. And if a bird shits on your windshield, you wipe it off before it can dry there. That was Dad's life, and I was the bird shit on his windshield. He was a big, quiet man with sandy hair, a complexion that burned easily, and a face that had a vague, but not unpleasant, touch of the simian. In the summertime, he always looked angry, with his face sunburned red and his eyes peering belligerently out at you like pale glints of water. Later, after I was 10, he was transferred to Boston, and we saw him only on weekends. But before that, he was stationed in Portland, and as far as I was concerned, he was like any other 9-to-5 father, except that his shirt was khaki instead of white, and his tie was always black. It says in the Bible that the sins of the fathers are visited upon the sons, and that may be true. But I could also add that the sins of other fathers' sons were visited on me. Being a recruiting chief was very tough on Dad, and I often thought he would have been much happier stationed out to sea, not to mention how much happier I would have been. For him, it was like having to go around and see other people's priceless antique cars driven to rack and ruin, mud-splattered, rust-eaten. He inducted high school Romeos, leaving their pregnant Juliets behind them. He inducted men who didn't know what they were getting into, and men who only cared about what they were getting out of. He got the sullen young men who had been made to choose between a bang in the Navy and a bang in South Portland training and correction. He got scared bookkeepers who had turned up 1A and would have done anything to keep away from the gooks in Nam, who were just then beginning their long-running special on pickled penis of American grunt. And he got the slack-jawed dropouts who had to be coached before they could sign their own names and had IQs to match their hat sizes. And there was me, right there at home, with some budding characteristics attributable to all of the above. Quite a challenge there. And you have to know that he didn't hate me just because I was there. He hated me because he was unequal to the challenge. He might have been if I hadn't been more my mother's child than his, and if my mother and I hadn't both known that. He called me a mama's boy. Maybe I was. One day in the fall of 1962, I took it into my head to throw rocks at the storm windows Dad was getting ready to put on. It was early October, a Saturday, and Dad was going at it the way he went at everything, with a step-by-step precision that precluded all error and waste. First, he got all the windows out of the garage, newly painted the spring before, green to match the house trim, and lined them up carefully against the house, one beside each window. I can see him, tall and sunburned and angry-looking, even under the cool October sun, in the vintage October air, which was as cool as kisses. October is such a fine month. I was sitting on the bottom step of the front porch, playing quiet and watching him. Every now and then a car would blip by, going up Route 9 toward Windsor or down 9 toward Harlow or Freeport. Mom was inside, playing the piano. Something minor, Bach, I think. But then whatever Mother played usually sounded like Bach. The wind tugged and pushed it, now bringing it to me, now carrying it away. Whenever I hear that piece now, I think about that day. Bach Fugue for Storm Windows in A minor. I sat and played quiet. A 1956 Ford with an out-of-state license plate went by. Up here to shoot partridge and pheasant, probably. A robin landed by the elm tree that threw shadows on my bedroom wall at night and pecked through the fallen leaves for a worm. My mother played on, right hand rippling the melody, left hand counterpointing it. Mother could play wonderful boogie-woogie when the urge struck her, but it didn't often. She just didn't like it, and it was probably just as well. Even her boogies sounded like Bach wrote them. All at once it occurred to me how wonderful it would be to break all those storm windows, to break them one by one, the upper panes and then the lower ones. You might think it was a piece of revenge, conscious or unconscious, a way to get back at the spit-and-polish all-hands-on-deck old man. But the truth is, I can't remember putting my father in that particular picture at all. The day was fine and beautiful. I was 4. It was a fine October day for breaking windows. I got up and went out to the soft shoulder and began picking up stones. I was wearing short pants, and I stuffed stones into the front pockets until it must have looked like I was carrying ostrich eggs. Another car went by, and I waved. The driver waved back. The woman beside him was holding a baby. I went back across the lawn, took a stone out of my pocket, and threw it at the storm window beside the living room window. I threw it as hard as I could. I missed. I took out another rock, and this time I moved right up on top of that window. A little chill went through my mind, disturbing my thoughts for a tiny moment. I couldn't miss, and didn't. I went right around the house, breaking windows. First the living room window, then the music room window. It was propped up against the brick side of the house, and after I broke it, I looked in at Mom, playing the piano. She was wearing a sheer blue slip. When she saw me peering in, she jumped a little and hit a sour note. Then she gave me a big sweet smile and went on playing. You can see how it was. She hadn't even heard me break the window. Funny in a way, there was no sense of doing anything wrong, just of doing something pleasurable. A little kid's selective perception is a strange thing. If the windows had been fastened on, I never would have dreamed of breaking them. I was regarding the last window, the one outside the den, when a hand fell on my shoulder and turned me around. It was my father. He was mad. I hadn't ever seen him so mad. His eyes were big, and he was biting his tongue between his teeth as if he were having a fit. I cried out, he scared me so bad. It was like your mother coming to the breakfast table with a Halloween mask on. Bastard! He picked me up in both hands, right hand holding my legs at the ankles and left hand holding my left arm against my chest, and then he threw me on the ground. It was hard as he could throw, I think. I lay there with all the breath out of me, staring up at the dismay and realization creeping over his face, dissolving the flash of his anger. I was unable to cry or speak or even move my diaphragm. There was a paralyzing pain in my chest and my crotch. I didn't mean it, he said, kneeling over me. You all right? You okay, Chuck? Chuck was what he called me when we were playing toss in the backyard. My lungs operated in a spasmodic, lurching gasp. I opened my mouth and let out a huge, screaming bray. The sound scared me, and the next scream was even louder. Tears turned everything to prisms. The sound of the piano stopped. You shouldn't have broken those windows, he said. Anger was replacing dismay. Now shut up. Be a man, for God's sake. He jerked me roughly to my feet just as Mom flew around the corner of the house, still in her slip. He broke all the storm windows, my father said. Go put something on. What's the matter? She cried. Oh, Charlie, did you cut yourself? Where? Show me where. He isn't cut, Dad said disgustedly. He's afraid he's going to get licked, and he damned well is. I ran to my mother and pressed my face into her belly, feeling the soft, comforting silk of her slip, smelling her sweet smell. My whole head felt swollen and pulpy like a turnip. My voice had turned into a cracked donkey bray. I closed my eyes tightly. What are you talking about licking him? He's purple. If you've hurt him, Carl... He started to cry when he saw me coming, for Christ's sake. The voices were coming from high above me, like amplified declarations from mountaintops. There's a car coming, he said. Go inside, Rita. Come on, love, my mother said. Smile for Mummy. Big smile. She pushed me away from her stomach and wiped tears from under my eyes. Have you ever had your mother wipe your tears away? About that, the hack poets are right. It's one of life's great experiences, right up there with your first ball game and your first wet dream. There, honey, there. Daddy didn't mean to be cross. That was Sam Castingway and his wife, my father said. Now you've given that motor mouth something to talk about. I hope... Come on, Charlie, she said, taking my hand. We'll have chocolate in my sewing room. The hell you will, Dad said curtly. I looked back at him. His fists were clenched angrily as he stood in front of the one window he had saved. He'll just puke it up when I whale the tar out of him. You'll whale no tar out of anyone, she said. You've scared him half to death already. Then he was over to her, not minding her slip anymore, or Sam and his wife. He grabbed her shoulder and pointed to the jagged kitchen storm window. Look, look, he did that, and now you want to give him chocolate. He's no baby anymore, Rita. It's time for you to stop giving him the tit. I cringed against her hip, and she wrenched her shoulder away. White finger marks stood out on her flesh for a moment and then filled in red. Go inside, she said calmly. You're being quite foolish, Carl. I'm going to... Don't tell me what you'll do, she shouted suddenly, advancing on him. He flinched away instinctively. Go inside. You've done enough damage. Go inside. Go find some of your friends and have drinks. Go anywhere, but get out of my sight. Punishment, he said deliberately. Did anyone teach you that word in college, or were they too busy filling you full of that liberal bullshit? Next time, he may break something more valuable than a few storm windows. A few times after that, he may break your heart. Wanton destruction. Get out! She screamed. I began to cry again and shrank away from them both. For a moment, I stood between, tottering, and then my mother gathered me up. It's all right, honey, she was saying. But I was watching my father, who had turned and was stomping away like a surly little boy. It wasn't until then, until I had seen with what practiced and dreadful ease he had been banished, that I began to dare to hate him back. While my mother and I were having cocoa in her sewing room, I told her how Dad had thrown me on the ground. I told her Dad had lied. It made me feel quite wonderful and strong. Chapter 17 What happened then? Susan Brooks asked breathlessly. Not much, I said. It blew over. Now that it was out, I found myself mildly surprised that it had stuck in my throat so long. I once knew a kid, Herc Orville, who ate a mouse. I dared him, and he swallowed it, raw. It was just a small field mouse, and it didn't look hurt at all when we found it. Maybe it had just died of old age. Anyway, Herc's mom was out hanging clothes, and she just happened to look over at us, sitting in the dirt by the back step. She looked just in time to see the mouse going down Herc's throat head first. She screamed. What a fright it can give you when a grown-up screams, and ran over and put her finger down Herc's throat. Herc threw up the mouse, the hamburger he'd eaten for lunch, and some pasty glop that looked like tomato soup. He was just starting to ask his mother what was going on when she threw up. And there, in all that puke, that old dead mouse didn't look bad at all. It sure looked better than the rest of the stuff. The moral seemed to be that puking up your past, when the present is even worse, makes some of the vomitus look nearly tasty. I started to tell them that, and then decided it would only revolt them, like the story of the Cherokee nose job. Dad was in the doghouse for a few days, that was all. No divorce, no big thing. Carol Granger started to say something, and that was when Ted stood up. His face was pale as cheese, except for two burning patches of red, one above each cheekbone. He was grinning. Did I tell you he wore his hair in a duck's ass cut? Grease, out of style, not cool. But Ted got away with it. In that click of a second when he stood up, he looked like the ghost of James Dean come to get me, and my heart quailed. "I'm going to take that gun away from you now, tin shit," he said, grinning. His teeth were white and even. I had to fight hard to keep my voice steady, but I think he did pretty well. "Sit down, Ted." Ted didn't move forward, but I could see how badly he wanted to. "That makes me sick, you know, trying to blame something like this on your folks." "Did I say I was trying to?" "Shut up," he said in a rising, strident voice. "You killed two people." "How really observant of you to notice," I said. He made a horrible rippling movement with his hands, holding them at waist level, and I knew that in his mind he had just grabbed me and eaten me. "Put that down, Charlie," he said, grinning. "Just put that gun down and fight me fair." "Why did you quit the football team, Ted?" I asked amiably. It was very hard to sound amiable, but it worked. He looked stunned, suddenly unsure, as if no one but the stolidly predictable coach had ever dared ask him that. He looked as if he had suddenly become aware of the fact that he was the only one standing. It was akin to the look a fellow gets when he realizes his zipper is down and is trying to think of a nice, unobtrusive way to get it back up, so it will look like an act of God. "Never mind that," he said. "Put down that gun." It sounded melodramatic as hell. Phony. He knew it. "Afraid for your balls? Your ever-loving sack? Was that it?" Irma Bates gasped. Sylvia, however, was watching with a certain predatory interest. "You..." He sat down suddenly in his seat, and somebody chuckled in the back of the room. "I've always wondered exactly who that was. Dick Keene? Harmon Jackson? But I saw their faces. And what I saw surprised me. You might even say it shocked me. Because there was pleasure there. There had been a showdown, a verbal shootout, you might say, and I had won. But why did that make them happy? Like those maddening pictures you sometimes see in the Sunday paper. Why are these people laughing? Turn to page 41. Only there was no page for me to turn to. And it's important to know, you know. I've thought and thought, racked whatever brains I have left, and I don't know. Maybe it was only Ted himself, handsome and brave, full of the same natural machismo that keeps the wars well attended. Simple jealousy, then. The need to see everyone at the same level, gargling in the same rat-race choir, to paraphrase Dylan. Take off your mask, Ted, and sit down with the rest of us regular guys. Ted was still staring at me, and I knew well enough that he was unbroken. Only next time he might not be so direct. Maybe next time he would try me on the flank. Maybe it's just mob spirit, jump on the individual. But I didn't believe that then, and I don't believe it now, although it would explain much. No, the subtle shift from Ted's end of the seesaw to mine could not be dismissed as some masked grunt of emotion. A mob always wipes out the strange one, the sport, the mutant. That was me, not Ted. Ted was the exact opposite of those things. He was a boy you would have been proud to have down in the rumpus room with your daughter. No, it was in Ted, not in them. It had to be in Ted. I began to feel strange tentacles of excitement in my belly, the way a butterfly collector must feel when he thinks he has just seen a new species fluttering in yon bushes. "I know why Ted quit football," a voice said slyly. I looked around. It was Pigpen. Kit had fairly jumped at the sound of his voice. He was beginning to look a wee bit haggard. "Do tell," I said. "If you open your mouth, I'll kill you," Ted said deliberately. He turned his grin on Pigpen. Pigpen blinked in a terrified way and licked his lips. He was torn. It was probably the first time in his life that he'd had the axe, and now he didn't know if he dared to grind it. Of course, almost anyone in the room could have told you how he came by any information he had. Mrs. Dano spent her life attending bazaars, rummage sales, church and school suppers, and Mrs. Dano had the longest, shrewdest nose in Gates Falls. I also suspected she held the record for party line listening in. She could latch on to anyone if he made an impotent clutching gesture with his hands. "Go on and tell," Sylvia Regan said suddenly. "Don't let Golden Boy scare you, hon." Pigpen gave her a quivering smile and then blurted out, "Mrs. Jones is an alcoholic. She had to go someplace and dry out. Ted had to help with his family." Silence for a second. "I'm going to kill you, Pigpen," Ted said, getting up. His face was dead pale. "Now, that's not nice," I said. "You said so yourself. Sit down." Ted glared at me, and for a moment I thought he was going to break and charge at me. If he had, I would have killed him. Maybe he could see it on my face. He sat back down. "So," I said, "the skeleton has boogied right out of the closet. Where is she drying out, Ted?" "Shut up," he said thickly. Some of his hair had fallen across his forehead. It looked greasy. It was the first time it had ever looked that way to me. "Oh, she's back now," Pigpen said, and offered Ted a forgiving smile. "You said you'd kill Pigpen," I said thoughtfully. "I will kill him," Ted muttered. His eyes were red and baleful. "Then you can blame it on your parents," I said, smiling. "Won't that be a relief?" Ted was gripping the edge of his desk tightly. Things weren't going to his liking at all. Harmon Jackson was smiling nastily. Maybe he had an old grudge against Ted. "Your father driver to it?" I asked kindly. "How'd it happen? Home late all the time? Supper burned and all that? Nipping on the cooking sherry a little at first? Hi-ho!" "I'll kill you," he moaned. I was needling him, needling the shit out of him, and no one was telling me to stop. It was incredible. They were all watching Ted with a glassy kind of interest, as if they had expected all along that there were a few maggots under there. "Must be tough being married to a big-time bank officer," I said. "Look at it that way. She probably didn't realize she was belting down the hard stuff so heavy. It can creep up on you. Look at it that way. It can get on top of you. And it's not your fault, is it? Hi-ho!" "Shut up!" he screamed at me. "There it was, right under your nose, but it just got out of control, am I right? Kind of disgusting, wasn't it? Did she really go to pot, Ted? Tell us. Get rid of it. Kind of just slopping around the house, was she?" "Shut up, shut up!" "Drunk in front of dialing for dollars? Seeing bugs in the corners? Or was she quiet about it? Did she see bugs? Did she? Did she go bugs?" "Yeah, it was disgusting," he brayed at me suddenly, through a mouthful of spit. "Almost as disgusting as you, killer, killer." "Did you write her?" I asked softly. "Why would I write her?" he asked wildly. "Why should I write her? She copped out." "And you couldn't play football." Ted Jones said clearly, "Drunk bitch." Carol Granger gasped, and the spell was broken. Ted's eyes seemed to clear a little. The red light went out of them, and he realized what he had said. "I'll get you for this, Charlie," he said quietly. "You might. You might get your chance," I smiled. "A drunken old bitch of a mother. That surely is disgusting, Ted." Ted sat silently staring at me. It was over, then. We could turn our attention to other things, at least for the moment. I had a feeling we might be getting back to Ted, or that he would get back to me. People moved around restlessly outside. The clock buzzed. No one said anything for a long time, or what seemed like a long time. There was a lot to think about now. Chapter 18. Sylvia Regan finally broke the silence. She threw back her head and laughed, long, hard, and loud. Several people, including me, jumped. Ted Jones didn't. He was still on his own trip. "You know what I'd like to do after this is over?" she asked. "What?" Pigpen asked. He looked surprised that he had spoken up again. Sandra Cross was looking at me gravely. She had her ankles crossed the way pretty girls do when they want to foil boys who want to look up their dresses. "I'd like to get this in a detective magazine. 60 Minutes of Terror with the Placerville Maniac. I'd get somebody who writes good to do it. Joe McKennedy or Phil Franks. Or maybe you, Charlie. How's that bite your banana? She guffawed, and Pigpen joined in tentatively. I think he was fascinated by Sylvia's fearlessness. Or maybe it was only her blatant sexuality. She sure didn't have her ankles crossed. Out on the lawn, two more trooper cars had arrived. The firemen were leaving. The fire alarm had cut out a few minutes ago. Abruptly, Mr. Grace disengaged himself from the crowd and started toward the main doors. A light breeze flapped the bottom of his sport coat. "More company," Corky Harrell said. I got up, went over to the intercom, and switched it back onto talk-listen. Then I sat down again, sweating a little. Mr. Don Godgivus Grace was on his way, and he was no lightweight. A few seconds later, there was that hollow chink that means the line is open. Mr. Grace said, "Charlie?" His voice was very calm, very rich, very certain. "How are you, Skinner?" I asked. "Fine, thanks, Charlie. How are you?" "Keeping my thumb on it," I said agreeably. Snickers from some of the boys. "Charlie, we've talked about getting help for you before this. Now you've committed a pretty antisocial act, wouldn't you agree?" "By whose standards?" "Society standards, Charlie. First Mr. Carlson, now this. Will you let us help you?" I almost asked him if my co-students weren't a part of society, because no one down here seemed too worked up about Mrs. Underwood. But I couldn't do that. It would have transgressed a set of rules that I was just beginning to grasp.
"How does I do it?" I bawled. "I already told that there Mr. Denver how sorry I is for hitting that little girl with that Lucyville slugger. I wants my poor head shrunk. I wants my soul saved and made white as snow. How does I do it, Reverend?"
Pat Fitzgerald, who was nearly as black as the ace of spades, laughed and shook his head. "Charlie, Charlie," Mr. Grace said as if very sad. "Only you can save your soul now." I didn't like that. I stopped shouting and put my hand on the pistol, as if for courage. I didn't like it at all. He had a way of slipping it to you. I'd seen him a lot since I bopped Mr. Carlson with the pipe wrench. He could really slip it in. "Mr. Grace?" "What, Charlie?" "Did Tom tell the police what I said?" "Don't you mean Mr. Denver?"
"Whatever, did he?"
"Yes, he relayed your message."
"Have they figured out how they're going to handle me yet?"
"I don't know, Charlie. I'm more interested in knowing if you've figured out how you're going to handle yourself." Oh, he was slipping it to me, all right. Just like he kept slipping it to me after Mr. Carlson. But then I had to go see him. Now I could turn him off any time I wanted to. Except I couldn't, and he knew I couldn't. It was too normal to be consistent. And I was being watched by my peerless peers. They were evaluating me. "Sweating a little?" I asked the intercom. "Are you?" "You guys," I said, an edge of bitterness creeping into my voice. "You're all the same." "We are? If so, then we all want to help you." He was going to be a much tougher nut to strip than old Tom Denver had been. That was obvious. I called Don Grace up in my mind. Short, dapper little fuck. Bald on top, big mutton chop sideburns, as if to make up for that. He favored tweed coats with suede patches on the elbows, a pipe always stuffed with something that came from Copenhagen and smelled like cow shit. A man with a head full of sharp, prying instruments. A mind fucker, a head stud. That's what a shrink is for, my friends and neighbors. Their job is to fuck the mentally disturbed and make them pregnant with sanity. It's a bull's job, and they go to school to learn how. And all their courses are variations on a theme, slipping it to the psychos for fun and profit, mostly profit. And if you find yourself someday lying on that great analyst's couch where so many have lain before you, I'd ask you to remember one thing. When you get sanity by stud, the child always looks like the father. And they have a very high suicide rate. But they get you lonely and ready to cry. They get you ready to toss it all over if they will just promise to go away for a while. What do we have? What do we really have? Minds like terrified fat men, begging the eyes that look up in the bus terminal or the restaurant and threaten to meet ours to look back down, uninterested. We lie awake and picture ourselves in white hats of varying shapes. There's no maidenhead too tough to withstand the seasoned dork of modern psychiatry. But maybe that was okay. Maybe now they would play my game, all these shysters and whores. Let us help you, Charlie. Mr. Grace was saying. But by letting you help me, I would be helping you. I said it as if the idea had just occurred to me. Don't want to do that. Why, Charlie?
Mr. Grace?
Yes, Charlie. The next time you ask me a question, I'm going to kill somebody down here. I could hear Mr. Grace suck wind as if someone had just told him his son had been in a car crash. It was a very unself-confident sound. It made me feel very good. Everyone in the room was looking at me tightly. Ted Jones raised his head slowly as if he had just awakened. I could see the familiar hating darkness cloud his eyes. Ann Lasky's eyes were round and frightened. Sylvia Reagan's fingers were doing a slow and dreamy ballet as they rummaged in her purse for another cigarette. And Sandra Cross was looking at me gravely, gravely, as if I were a doctor or a priest. Mr. Grace began to speak.
Watch it, I said sharply. Before you say anything, be careful. You aren't playing your game any longer, understand that. You're playing mine. Statements only. Be very careful. Can you be very careful?
He didn't say anything about my game metaphor at all. That was when I began to believe I had him. Charlie. Was that almost a plea?
Very good. Do you think you'll be able to keep your job after this, Mr. Grace?
Charlie, for God's sake.
Ever so much better.
Let them go, Charlie. Save yourself, please.
You're talking too fast. Pretty soon a question will pop out, and that'll be the end for somebody.
Charlie, how was your military obligation fulfilled?
What?
Sudden whistling of breath as he cut that off.
You almost killed somebody, I said.
Careful, Don. I can call you Don, can't I?
Sure.
Weigh those words, Don. I was reaching out for him. I was going to break him. In that second, it seemed as if maybe I could break them all. I think I better sign off for the moment, Charlie.
If you go before I say you can, I'll shoot somebody. What you're going to do is sit there and answer my questions.
The first sweaty desperation, as well concealed as underarm perspiration at the junior prom. I really mustn't, Charlie. I can't take the responsibility for...
Responsibility?
I screamed.
My God, you've been taking the responsibility ever since they let you loose from college. Now you want to cop out the first time your bare ass is showing. But I'm in the driver's seat, and by God, you'll pull the car. Or I'll do just what I said. You dig it? Do you understand me?
I won't play a cheap parlor game with human lives for party favors, Charlie.
Congratulations to you, I said. You just described modern psychiatry. That ought to be the textbook definition, Don.
Now, let me tell you, you'll take a piss out the window if I tell you to. And God help you if I catch you in a lie. That will get somebody killed, too. Ready to bare your soul, Don? Are you on your mark? He drew in his breath raggedly. He wanted to ask if I really meant it, but he was afraid I might answer with the gun instead of my mouth. He wanted to reach out quick and shut off the intercom, but he knew he would hear the echo of the shot in the empty building, rolling around in the corridor below him like a bowling ball up a long alley from hell. All right, I said. I unbuttoned my shirt cuffs. Out on the lawn, the cops and Tom Denver and Mr. Johnson were standing around restlessly, waiting for the return of their Tweety bull stud. Read my dreams, Sigmund. Squirt 'em with the sperm of symbols and make 'em grow. Show me how we're different from, say, rabid dogs or old tigers full of bad blood. Show me the man hiding between my wet dreams. They had every reason to be confident, although they did not look confident. In the symbolic sense, Mr. Grace was pathfinder of the Western world, bullstead with a compass. Natty Bumpo was breathing raggedly from the little latticed box over my head. I wondered if he'd read any good rapid eye movements lately. I wondered what his own would be like when night finally came. All right, Don, let's get it on. Chapter 19. How was your military obligation fulfilled? In the Army, Charlie. This isn't going to accomplish anything.
In what capacity?
As a doctor.
Psychiatrist?
No.
How long have you been a practicing psychiatrist?
5 years. Have you ever eaten your wife out?
What?
Terrified, angry pause. I don't know the meaning of the phrase. I'll rephrase it then. Have you ever engaged in oral genital practices with your wife? I won't answer that. You have no right.
I have all the rights. You have none. Answer or I'll shoot someone. And remember, if you lie and I catch you in a lie, I'll shoot someone. Have you ever engaged in...
No.
How long have you been a practicing psychiatrist?
5 years.
Why?
Well, because it fulfills me as a person.
Has your wife ever had an affair with another man?
No.
Another woman?
No.
How do you know?
She loves me.
Has your wife ever given you a blowjob, Don?
I don't know what you...
You know goddamn well what I mean.
No, Charlie, I...
Ever cheat on an exam in college?
Pause. Absolutely not.
On a quiz?
No. I pounced.
Then how can you say your wife has never engaged in oral genital sex practices with you?
I never... Charlie.
Where did you do your basic training?
Fort Benning.
What year?
I don't remember.
Give me a year or I'm going to shoot somebody down here.
1956.
Were you a grunt?
I don't...
Were you a grunt? Were you a dog face?
I was an officer. First Lieutenant.
I didn't ask you for that,
I screamed. Charlie, for God's sake, calm down.
What year was your military obligation fulfilled?
In 1960.
You owe your country 6 years. You're lying. I'm going to shoot.
No, he cried.
National Guard. I was in the Guard. What was your mother's maiden name?
Gavin.
Why?
I don't know what you...
Why was her maiden name Gavin?
Because her father's name was Gavin.
Charlie. In what year did you do your basic training?
1956.
You're lying. Caught you, didn't I, Don?
No.
You started to say 57.
I was mixed up.
I'm going to shoot somebody. In the guts, I think. Yes. Charlie, for Jesus' sake. Don't let it happen again. You were a grunt, right? In the army?
Yes. No, I was an officer.
What was your father's middle name?
John. Charlie, get hold of yourself. Don't.
Ever gobbled your wife, my man?
No.
You're lying. You said you didn't know what that meant.
You explained it to me. He was breathing in fast little grunts. Let me go, Charlie. Let me go.
What is your religious denomination?
Methodist.
In the choir?
No.
Did you go to Sunday school?
Yes.
What are the first three words in the Bible?
Pause. In the beginning.
First line of the 23rd Psalm?
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
And you first ate your wife in 1956?
Yes, no. Charlie, let me alone.
Basic training, what year?
1956.
You said 57 before, I screamed. Here it goes, I'm going to blow someone's head off right now.
I said 56, you bastard. Screaming out of breath, hysterical.
What happened to Jonah, Don?
He was swallowed by a whale.
The Bible says big fish, Don. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, big fish. Of course it was. Pitifully eager.
Who built the ark?
Noah.
Where did you do your basic?
Fort Benning. More confident, familiar ground. He was letting himself be lulled.
Ever eaten your wife?
No.
What?
No.
What's the last book in the Bible, Don?
Revelations.
Actually, it's just Revelation. No S, right?
Right, sure, right.
Who wrote it?
John.
What was your father's middle name?
John.
Ever get a revelation from your father, Don?
A strange, high, cackling laugh from Don Grace. Some of the kids blinked uneasily at the sound of that laugh.
No, Charlie, I can't say that I ever did. What was your mother's maiden name?
Gavin.
Is Christ numbered among the martyrs?
Yes. He was too Methodist to really be sure.
How was he martyred?
By the cross, crucified.
What did Christ ask God on the cross?
My God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Don?
Yes, Charlie.
What did you just say?
I said, my God, why... Pause.
Oh, no, Charlie, that's not fair. You asked a question. You tricked me. You just killed someone, Don. Sorry.
No. I fired the pistol into the floor. The whole class, which had been listening with taut, hypnotic attention, flinched. Several people screamed. Pigpen fainted again, and he struck the floor with a satisfying meat thump. I don't know if the intercom picked it up, but it really didn't matter. Mr. Grace was crying, sobbing like a baby. Satisfactory, I said to no one in particular. Very satisfactory. Things seemed to be progressing nicely. I let him sob for the best part of a minute. The cops had started toward the school at the sound of the shot, but Tom Denver, still betting on his shrink, held them back, and so that was all right. Mr. Gray sounded like a very small child, helpless, hopeless. I had made him fuck himself with his own big tool, like one of those weird experiences you read about in the Penthouse Forum. I had taken off his witch doctor's mask and made him human. But I didn't hold it against him. To err is only human, but it's divine to forgive. I believe that sincerely. Mr. Grace, I said finally. I'm going outside now, he said, and then with cheerful rebelliousness, and you can't stop me. That's all right, I said tenderly. The game's over, Mr. Grace. We weren't playing for keepsies this time. No one is dead down here. I shot into the floor. Breathing silence. Then tiredly, how can I believe you, Charlie? Because there would have been a stampede. Instead of saying that, I pointed. Ted? This is Ted Jones, Mr. Grace, Ted said mechanically. Yes, Ted. He shot into the floor, Ted said in a robot voice. Everyone is all right. Then he grinned and began to speak again. I pointed the pistol at him, and he shut his mouth with a snap. Thank you, Ted. Thank you, my boy. Mr. Grace began to sob again. After what seemed like a long, long time, he shut the intercom off. A long time after that, he came into view on the lawn again, walking toward the enclave of cops on the lawn, walking in his tweed coat with the suede elbow patches, bald head gleaming, cheeks gleaming. He was walking slowly, like an old man. It was amazing how much I liked seeing him walk like that. Chapter 20. Oh, man, Richard Keene said from the back of the room, and his voice sounded tired and sighing, almost exhausted. That was when a small, savagely happy voice broke in. I thought it was great. I craned my neck around. It was a tiny Dutch doll of a girl named Grace Stanner. She was pretty in a way that attracted the shop course boys, who still slicked their hair back and wore white socks. They hung around her in the hall like droning bees. She wore tight sweaters and short skirts. When she walked, everything jiggled. As Chuck Berry has said in his wisdom, it's such a sight to see somebody steal the show. Her mom was no prize, from what I understood. She was sort of a pro-am barfly and spent most of her time hanging around at Denny's on South Main, about a half mile up from what they call the corner here in Placerville. Denny's will never be mistaken for Caesar's Palace. And there are always a lot of small minds in small towns, eager to think like mother, like daughter. Now she was wearing a pink cardigan sweater and a dark green skirt, thigh high. Her face was alight, elvish. She had raised one clenched fist unconsciously shoulder high, and there was something crystal and poignant about the moment. I actually felt my throat tighten. Go, Charlie. Fuck 'em all. A lot of heads snapped around and a lot of mouths dropped open, but I wasn't too surprised. I told you about the roulette ball, didn't I? Sure I did. In some ways, in a lot of ways, it was still in spin. Craziness is only a matter of degree, and there are lots of people besides me who have the urge to roll heads. They go to the stock car races and the horror movies and the wrestling matches they have in the Portland Expo. Maybe what she said smacked of all those things, but I admired her for saying it out loud all the same. The price of honesty is always high. She had an admirable grasp of the fundamentals. Besides, she was tiny and pretty. Irma Bates wheeled on her, face stretched with outrage. It suddenly struck me that what was happening to Irma must be nearly cataclysmic. Dirty mouth. Fuck you, too. Grace shot back at her, smiling. Then, as an afterthought, bag. Irma's mouth dropped open. She struggled for words. I could see her throat working as she tried them, rejected them, tried more, looking for the words of power that would line Grace's face, drop her breasts 4 inches toward her belly, pop up varicose veins on those smooth thighs, and turn her hair gray. Surely those words were there someplace, and it was only a matter of finding them. So she struggled. And with her low-slung chin and bulging forehead, both generously sprinkled with blackheads, she looked like a frog. She finally sprayed out, "They ought to shoot you just like they'll shoot him, you slut!" She worked for more. It wasn't enough. It couldn't yet express all the horror and outrage she felt for this violent rip in the seam of her universe. Kill all sluts, sluts and sluts' daughters. The room had been quiet, but now it became absolutely silent, a pool of silence. A mental spotlight had been switched on Irma and Grace. They might have been alone in a pool of light on a huge stage. Up to this last, Grace had been smiling slightly. Now the smile was wiped off. What? Grace asked slowly. What? What? Baggage, tramp. Grace stood up as if about to recite poetry. My mother works in a laundry, you fat bitch, and you better take back what you just said. Irma's eyes rolled in caged and desperate triumph. Her neck was slick and shiny with sweat, the anxious sweat of the adolescent damned, the ones who sit home Friday nights and watch old movies on TV, and also the clock, the ones for whom the phone is always mute, and the voice of the mother is the voice of Thor, the ones who peck endlessly at the mustache shadow between nose and upper lip, the ones who go to see Robert Redford with their girlfriends and then come back alone on another day to see him again, with their palms clutched damply in their laps. The ones who agonize over long, seldom-mailed letters to John Travolta, written by the close, anxious light of tensor study lamps. The ones for whom time has become a slow and dreamy sledge of doom, bringing only empty rooms and the smell of old sweats. Sure, that neck was slimy with sweat. I wouldn't kid you any more than I would myself. She opened her mouth, then brayed, "Whore's daughter!" "Okay," Grace said. She had started up the aisle toward Irma, holding her hands out in front of her like a stage hypnotist's. She had very long fingernails, lacquered the color of pearl. "I'm going to claw your eyes out, cunt. Whore's daughter, whore's daughter." She was almost singing it. Grace smiled. Her eyes were still alight and elvish. She wasn't hurrying up that aisle, but she wasn't lagging either. No, she was coming right along. She was pretty, as I had never noticed before, pretty and precious. It was as if she had become a secret cameo of herself. "Okay, Irma," she said. "Here I come. Here I come for your eyes." Irma, suddenly aware, shrank back in her seat. "Stop," I said to Grace. I didn't pick up the pistol, but I laid my hand on it. Grace stopped and looked at me inquiringly. Irma looked relieved and also vindicated, as if I had taken on aspects of a justly intervening god. "Whore's daughter," she confided to the class in general. "Mrs. Stanner has open house every night, just as soon as she gets back from the beer joint, with her as practicing apprentice." She smiled sickly at Grace, a smile that was supposed to convey a superficial, cutting sympathy, and instead only inscribed her own pitiful, empty terror. Grace was still looking at me inquiringly. "Irma?" I asked politely. "Can I have your attention, Irma?" And when she looked at me, I saw fully what was happening. Her eyes had a glittery yet opaque sheen. Her face was flushed of cheek but waxy of brow. She looked like something you might send your kid out wearing for Halloween. She was blowing up. The whole thing had offended whatever shrieking albino bat it was that passed for her soul. She was ready to go straight up to heaven or dive bomb down into hell. "Good," I said when both of them were looking at me. "Now, we have to keep order here. I'm sure you understand that. Without order, what do you have? The jungle. And the best way to keep order is to settle our difficulties in a civilized way." "Hear, hear," Harmon Jackson said. I got up, went to the blackboard, and took a piece of chalk from the ledge. Then I drew a large circle on the tiled floor, perhaps 5 feet through the middle. I kept a close eye on Ted Jones while I did it, too. Then I went back to the desk and sat down. I gestured to the circle. "Please, girls." Grace came forward quickly, precious and perfect. Her complexion was smooth and fair. Irma sat stony. "Irma," I said. "Now, Irma, you've made accusations, you know." Irma looked faintly surprised, as if the idea of accusations had exploded an entirely new train of thought in her mind. She nodded and rose from her seat with one hand cupped demurely over her mouth, as if to stifle a tiny coquettish giggle. She stepped mincingly up the aisle and into the circle, standing as far away from Grace as was possible, eyes cast demurely down, hands linked together at her waist. She looked ready to sing Granada on the gong show. I thought randomly, her father sells cars, doesn't he? "Very good," I said. "Now, as has been hinted at in church, in school, and even on howdy doody, a single step outside the circle means death, understood?" They understood that. They all understood it. This is not the same as comprehension, but it was good enough. When you stop to think, the whole idea of comprehension has a faintly archaic taste, like the sound of forgotten tongues or a look into a Victorian camera obscura. We Americans are much higher on simple understanding. It makes it easier to read the billboards when you're heading into town on the expressway at plus 50. To comprehend, the mental jaws have to gape wide enough to make the tendons creak. Understanding, however, can be purchased on every paperback book rack in America. Now, I said, I would like a minimum of physical violence here. We already have enough of that to think about. I think your mouths and your open hands will be sufficient, girls. I will be the judge. Accepted? They nodded. I reached into my back pocket and brought out my red bandana. I had bought it at the Ben Franklin Five and Dime downtown, and a couple of times I had worn it to school and knotted around my neck, very continental. But I had gotten tired of the effect and put it to work as a snot rag. Bourgeois to the core, that's me. When I drop it, you go at it. First lick to you, Grace, as you seem to be the defendant. Grace nodded brightly. There were roses in her cheeks. That's what my mother always says about someone who has high color. Irma Bates just looked demurely at my red bandana. Stop it, Ted Jones snapped. You said you weren't going to hurt anyone, Charlie. Now stop it. His eyes looked desperate. Just stop it. For no reason I could fathom, Don Lordy laughed crazily. She started it, Ted Jones, Sylvia Reagan said heatedly. If some Ethiopian jug-diddler called my mother a whore... Whore, dirty whore, Irma agreed demurely. I'd claw her fucking eyes out. You're crazy, Ted bellowed at her, his face the color of old brick. We could stop him. If we all got together, we could... Shut up, Ted, Dick Keene said. Okay? Ted looked around, saw he had neither support nor sympathy, and shut up. His eyes were dark and full of crazy hate. I was glad it was a good long run between his desk and Mrs. Underwood's. I could shoot him in the foot if I had to. Ready, girls? Grace Stanner grinned a healthy, gutsy grin. All ready. Irma nodded. She was a big girl, standing with her legs apart and her head slightly lowered. Her hair was a dirty blonde color, done in round curls that looked like toilet paper rolls. I dropped my bandana. It was on. Grace stood thinking about it. I could almost see her realizing how deep it could be, wondering maybe how far in over her head she wanted to get. In that instant, I loved her. No, I loved them both. You're a fat, big-mouthed bitch, Grace said, looking Irma in the eye. You stink. I mean that. Your body stinks. You're a louse. Good, I said when she was done. Give her a smack. Grace hauled off and slapped the side of Irma's face. It made a flat, whapping noise, like one board striking another. Her sweater pulled up above the waistband of her skirt with a swing of her arm. Corky Harold went, "Una," under his breath. Irma let out a whooping grunt. Her head snapped back, her face screwed up. She didn't look demure anymore. There was a large, hectic patch on her left cheek. Grace threw back her head, drew a sudden knife breath, and stood ready. Her hair spilled over her shoulders, beautiful and perfect. She waited. "Irma for the prosecution," I said. "Go ahead, Irma." Irma was breathing heavily. Her eyes were glazed and offended, her mouth horrified. At that moment, she looked like no one's sweet child of mourning. "Whore," she said finally, apparently deciding to stick with a winner. Her lip lifted, fell, and lifted again like a dog's. "Dirty boy-fucking whore." I nodded to her. Irma grinned. She was very big. Her arm coming around was like a wall. It rocketed against the side of Grace's face. The sound was a sharp crack. "Ow," someone whined. Grace didn't fall over. The whole side of her face went red, but she didn't fall over. Instead, she smiled at Irma, and Irma flinched. I saw it and could hardly believe it. Dracula had feet of clay, after all. I snatched a quick look at the audience. They were hung, hypnotized. They weren't thinking about Mr. Grace or Tom Denver or Charles Everett Decker. They were watching, and maybe what they saw was a little bit of their own souls flashed at them in a cracked mirror. It was fine. It was like new grass in spring. "Rebuttal, Grace?" I asked. Grace's lips drew back from her tiny ivory teeth. "You never had a date, that's what's the matter with you. You're ugly, you smell bad, and so all you think about is what other people do, and you have to make it all dirty in your mind. You're a bug." I nodded to her. Grace swung, and Irma shied away. The blow struck her only glancingly, but she began to weep with a sudden slow hopelessness. "Let me out," she groaned. I don't want to anymore, Charlie. Let me out.
Take back what you said about my mother, Grace said grimly.
Your mother sucks cocks, Irma screamed.
Her face was twisted. Her toilet roll curls bobbed madly.
Good, I said.
Go ahead, Irma.
But Irma was weeping hysterically.
Jesus,
she screamed. Her arms came up and covered her face with terrifying slowness.
God, I want to be dead.
Say you're sorry, Grace said grimly. Take it back.
You suck cocks,
Irma screamed from behind the barricade of her arms.
Okay, I said. Let her have it, Irma. Last chance.
This time, Irma swung from the heels. I saw Grace's eyes squeeze into slits, saw the muscles of her neck tighten into cords, but the angle of her jaw caught most of the blow and her head shifted only slightly. Still, that whole side of her face was bright red as if from sunburn. Irma's whole body jogged and jiggled with the force of her sobs, which seemed to come from a deep well in her that had never been tapped before.
You haven't got nothing, Grace said. You ain't nothing. Just a fat, stinky pig is what you are.
Hey, give it to her!
Billy Sawyer yelled. He slammed both fists down heavily on his desk.
Hey, pour it on!
You ain't even got any friends, Grace said, breathing hard. Why do you even bother living? Irma let out a thin, reedy wail.
All done, Grace said to me.
Okay, I said. Give it to her. Grace drew back, and Irma screamed and went to her knees.
Don't hit me! Don't hit me no more! Don't you hit me!
Say you're sorry.
I can't, she wept. Don't you know I can't?
You can. You better. There was no sound for a moment, but the vague buzz of the wall clock. Then Irma looked up, and Grace's hand came down fast, amazingly fast, making a small ladylike splat against Irma's cheek. It sounded like a shot from a .22. Irma fell heavily on one hand, her curls hanging in her face. She drew in a huge ragged breath and screamed,
Okay, all right, I'm sorry.
Grace stepped back, her mouth half open and moist, breathing rapidly and shallowly. She raised her hands, palms out, in a curiously dove-like gesture, and pushed her hair away from her cheeks. Irma looked up at her dumbly, unbelievingly. She struggled to her knees again, and for a moment I thought she was going to offer a prayer to Grace. Then she began to weep. Grace looked at the class, then looked at me. Her breasts were very full, pushing at the soft fabric of her sweater.
My mother fucks, she said, and I love her.
The applause started somewhere in the back, maybe with Mike Gavin or Nancy Kaskin, but it started and spread until they were all applauding, all but Ted Jones and Susan Brooks. Susan looked too overwhelmed to applaud. She was looking at Gracie Stanner, shiningly. Irma knelt on the floor, her face in her hands. When the applause died, I had looked at Sandra Cross. She applauded very gently, as if in a dream. I said, Stand up, Irma. She looked at me wonderingly, her face streaked and shadowed and ravaged as if she had been in a dream herself. Leave her alone, Ted said, each word distinct.
Shut up, Harmon Jackson said. Charlie is doing all right.
Ted turned around in his seat and looked at him, but Harmon did not drop his eyes as he might have done at another place another time. They were both on the student council together, where Ted, of course, had always been the power.
Stand up, Irma, I said gently.
Are you going to shoot me? She whispered.
You said you were sorry.
She made me say it.
But I bet you are.
Irma looked at me dumbly from beneath the madhouse of her toilet paper roll curls.
I've always been sorry, she said. That's what makes it so hard to say.
Do you forgive her? I asked Grace.
Huh? Grace looked at me a little dazed.
Oh, yeah, sure.
She walked suddenly back to her seat and sat down, where she looked frowningly at her hands. Irma, I said.
What?
She was peering at me, dog-like, truculent, fearful, pitiful. Do you have something you want to say?
I don't know.
She stood up a little at a time. Her hands dangled strangely as if she didn't know exactly what to do with them.
I think you do.
You'll feel better when it's off your chest, Irma, Tannis Gannon said.
I always do.
Leave her alone, for Christ's sake, Dick Keene said from the back of the room.
I don't want to be left alone, Irma said suddenly. I want to say it.
She brushed back her hair defiantly. Her hands were not dove-like at all. I'm not pretty. No one likes me. I never had a date. Everything she said is true. There. The words rushed out very fast, and she screwed up her face while she was saying them, as if she were taking nasty medicine. "Take a little care of yourself," Tanis said. Then, looking embarrassed but still determined, "You know, wash, shave your legs and armpits. Look nice. I'm no raving beauty, but I don't stay home every weekend. You could do it." "I don't know how." Some of the boys were beginning to look uneasy, but the girls were leaning forward. They looked sympathetic now, all of them. They had that confessions at the pajama party look that every male seems to know and dread. "Well," Tanis began. Then she stopped and shook her head. "Come back here and sit down." Pat Fitzgerald snickered. "Trade secrets?"
"That's right."
"Some trade," Corky Harold said. That got laughs. Irma Bates shuttled to the back of the room, where she, Tanis, Ann Lasky, and Susan Brooks started some sort of confabulation. Sylvia was talking softly with Grace, and Pigpen's eyes were crawling avidly over both of them. Ted Jones was frowning at the air. George Yannick was carving something on the top of his desk and smoking a cigarette. He looked like any busy carpenter. Most of the others were looking out the windows at the cops directing traffic and conferring in desperate-looking little huddles. I could pick out Don Grace, good old Tom Denver, and Jerry Kesserling, the traffic cop. A bell went off suddenly with a loud bray, making all of us jump. It made the cops outside jump, too. A couple of them pulled their guns. "Change of classes, Bell," Harmon said. I looked at the wall clock. It was 9:50. At 9:05, I had been sitting in my seat by the window watching the squirrel. Now the squirrel was gone. Good old Tom Denver was gone. And Mrs. Underwood was really gone. I thought it over and decided I was gone, too. Chapter 21. Three more state police cars came, and also a number of citizens from town. The cops tried to shoo them away with greater or lesser degrees of success. Mr. Frankel, owner and proprietor of Frankel's jewelry store and camera shop, drove up in his new Pontiac Firebird and jawed for quite a while with Jerry Kesserling. He pushed his horn-rimmed glasses up on his nose constantly as he talked. Jerry was trying to get rid of him, but Mr. Frankel wasn't having any of it. He was also Placerville's second selectman and a crony of Norman Jones, Ted's father. "My mother got me a ring in his store," Sarah Pastern said, looking at Ted from the corner of her eye. "It greened my finger the first day." "My mother says he's a gyp," Tanis said. "Hey," Pigpen gulped, "there's my mother." We all looked. Sure enough, there was Mrs. Dano talking with one of the state troopers, her slit hanging a quarter of an inch below the hem of her dress. She was one of those ladies who do 50% of their talking with their hands. They fluttered and whipped like flags, and it made me think of autumn Saturdays on the gridiron somehow, holding, clipping, illegal tackle. I guess in this case you'd have to say it was illegal holding. We all knew her by sight as well as by reputation. She headed up a lot of PTA functions and was a member in good standing of the Mother's Club. Go out to a baked bean supper to benefit the class trip, or to the Sadie Hawkins dance in the gym, or to the senior outing. And you'd be apt to find Mrs. Dano at the door, ready with the old glad hand, grinning like there was no tomorrow, and collecting bits of information, the way frogs catch flies. Pigpen shifted nervously in his seat as if he might have to go to the bathroom. "Hey, Pen, your mother's calling," Jack Goldman intoned from the back of the room. "Let her call," Pigpen muttered. The Pen had an older sister, Lily Dano, who was a senior when we were all freshmen. She had a face that looked a lot like Pigpen's, which made her nobody's candidate for teen queen. A hook-nosed junior named La Follette St. Armand began squiring her about, and then knocked her up higher than a kite. La Follette joined the Marines, where they presumably taught him the difference between his rifle and his gun, which was for shooting and which was for fun. Mrs. Dano appeared at no PTA functions for the next 2 months. Lily was packed off to an aunt in Boxford, Massachusetts. Shortly after that, Mrs. Dano returned to the same old stand, grinning harder than ever. It's a small-town classic, friends. "She must be really worried about you," Carol Granger said. "Who cares?" Pigpen asked indifferently. Sylvia Reagan smiled at him. Pigpen blushed. Nobody said anything for a while. We watched the townspeople mill around beyond the bright yellow crash barricades that were going up. I saw some other mums and dads among them. I didn't see Sandra's mother and father, and I didn't see Big Joe McKennedy. Hey, I didn't really expect he'd show up anyway. Circuses have never been our style. A newsmobile from WGAN-TV pulled up. One of the guys got out, patting his process neatly into place, and jawed with a cop. The cop pointed across the road. The guy with the process went back to the newsmobile, and two more guys got out and started unloading camera equipment. "Anybody here got a transistor radio?" I asked. Three of them raised hands. Corky's was the biggest, a Sony 12 transistor that he carried in his briefcase. It got six bands, including TV, shortwave, and CB. He put it on his desk and turned it on. We were just in time for the 10 o'clock report. Topping the headlines, a Placerville High School senior, Charles Everett Decker.
Everett,
somebody snickered. Shut up, Ed said curtly. Pat Fitzgerald stuck out his tongue. Apparently went berserk early this morning and is now holding 24 classmates hostage in a classroom of that high school. One person, Peter Vance, 37, a history teacher at Placerville, is known dead. Another teacher, Mrs. Jean Underwood, also 37, is feared dead. Decker has commandeered the intercom system and has communicated twice with school authorities. The list of hostages is as follows. He read down the class list as I had given it to Tom Denver. I'm on the radio, Nancy Kaskin exclaimed when they reached her name. She blinked and smiled tentatively. Melvin Thomas whistled. Nancy colored and told him to shut up. And George Yannick. Frank Philbrick, head of the Maine State Police, has asked that all friends and family stay away from the scene. Decker is presumed dangerous, and Philbrick emphasized that nobody knows at this time what might set him off. We have to assume that the boy is still on a hair trigger, Philbrick said. Want to pull my trigger? I asked Sylvia. Is your safety on? She asked right back, and the class roared. Ann Lasky laughed with her hands over her mouth, blushing a deep bright red. Ted Jones, our practicing party poop, scowled. Grace, Placerville's psychiatrist and guidance counselor, talked to Decker over the intercom system only minutes ago. Grace told reporters that Decker threatened to kill someone in the classroom if Grace did not leave the upstairs office immediately. Liar, Grace Stanner said musically. Irma jumped a little. Who does he think he is? Melvin asked angrily. Does he think he can get away with that shit? Also said that he considers Decker to be a schizophrenic personality, possibly past the point of anything other than borderline rationality. Grace concluded his hurried remarks by saying, At this point, Charles Decker might conceivably do anything. Police from the surrounding towns of... What a crock of shit! Sylvia blared. I'm going to tell those guys what really went down with that guy when we get out of here. I'm going to... Shut up and listen! Dick Keene snapped at her. And Lewiston had been summoned to the scene. At this moment, according to Captain Philbrick, the situation is at an impasse. Decker is sworn to kill if tear gas is used, and with the lives of 24 children at stake...
Children, Pigpen said suddenly. Children this and children that.
They stabbed you in the back, Charlie. Already.
Children.
Ha, shit. What do they think is happening, I... He's saying something about... Corky began. Never mind, turn it off, I said. This sounds more interesting. I fixed the pen with my best steely gaze. What seems to be on your mind, pard? Pigpen jerked his thumb at Irma. She thinks she's got it bad, he said. Her, heh. He laughed a sudden erratic laugh. For no particular reason I could make out, he removed a pencil from his breast pocket and looked at it. It was a purple pencil. Bebop pencil, Pigpen said. Cheapest pencils on the face of the earth, that's what I think. Can't sharpen them at all. Lead breaks. Every September since I started first grade, Ma comes home from the Mammoth Mart with 200 Bebop pencils in a plastic box. And I use them. Jesus. He snapped his purple pencil between his thumbs and stared at it. To tell the truth, I did think it looked like a pretty cheap pencil. I've always used the Eberhard Faber myself. Ma, Pigpen said, that's Ma for you. 200 Bebop pencils in a plastic box. You know what her big thing is? Besides all those shitty suppers where they give you a big plate of hamburger helper and a paper cup of orange jello full of grated carrots, huh? She enters contests. That's her hobby. Hundreds of contests, all the time. She subscribes to all the women's magazines and enters the sweepstakes. Why she likes Rinso for all her dainty things in 25 words or less. My sister had a kitten once and Mom wouldn't even let her keep it. She the one who got pregnant? Corky asked. Wouldn't even let her keep it, Pigpen said. Drowned it in the bathtub when no one would take it. Lily begged her to at least take it to the vet so it could have gas, and Ma said $4 for gas was too much to spend on a worthless kitten. Oh, poor thing, Susan Brooks said. I swear to God, she did it right in the bathtub. All those goddamn pencils. Will she buy me a new shirt, huh? Maybe for my birthday. I say, Ma, you should hear what the kids call me. Ma, for Lord's sake. I don't even get an allowance. She says she needs it for postage so she can enter her contests. A new shirt for my birthday and a shitload of Bebop pencils in a plastic box to take back to school. I tried to get a paper route once, and she put a stop to that. She said there were women of loose virtue who laid in wait for young boys after their husbands went to work. Oh, my God, Sylvia bellowed. And contests, and PTA suppers, and chaperoning dances, grabbing onto everybody, sucking up to them and grinning. He looked at me and smiled the oddest smile I had seen all day, and that was going some. You know what she said when Lily had to go away? She said I'd have to sell my car, that old Dodge my uncle gave me when I got my driver's license. I said I wouldn't. I said Uncle Fred gave it to me and I was going to keep it. She said if I wouldn't sell it, she would. She'd signed all the papers and legally it was hers. She said I wasn't going to get any girl pregnant in the back seat. Me, get a girl pregnant in the back seat. That's what she said. He brandished a broken pencil half. The lead poked out of the wood like a black bone. Me. Huh. The last date I had was for the 8th grade class picnic. I told Ma I wouldn't sell the Dodge. She said I would. I ended up selling it. I knew I would. I can't fight her. She always knows what to say. You start giving her a reason why you can't sell your car, and she says, then how come you stay in the bathroom so long? Right off the wall. You're talking about the car, and she's talking about the bathroom, like you're doing something dirty in there. She grinds you. She stared out the window. Mrs. Dino was no longer in sight. She grinds and grinds and grinds, and she always beats you. Bebop pencils that break every time you try to sharpen them. That's how she beats you. That's how she grinds you down. And she's so mean and stupid. She drowned the kitty, just a little kitty, and she's so stupid that, you know, everybody laughs at her behind her back. So what does that make me? Littler and stupider. After a while, you feel just like a little kitty that crawled into a plastic box full of Bebop pencils and got brought home by mistake. The room was dead quiet. Pigpen had center stage. I don't think he knew it. He looked grubby and pissed off, fists clenched around his broken pencil halves. Outside, a cop had driven a police cruiser onto the lawn. He parked it parallel to the school, and a few more cops ran down behind it, presumably to do secret things. They had riot guns in their hands. I don't think I'd mind if she snuffed it, Pigpen said, grinning a small, horrified grin. I wish I had your stick, Charlie. If I had your stick, I think I'd kill her myself. You're crazy, too, Ted said worriedly. God, you're all going crazy right along with him. Don't be such a creep, Ted. It was Carol Granger. In a way, it was surprising not to find her on Ted's side. I knew he had taken her out a few times before she started with her current steady, and bright establishment types usually stick together. Still, it had been she who had dropped him. To make a very clumsy analogy, I was beginning to suspect that Ted was to my classmates what Eisenhower must always have been to the dedicated liberals of the 50s. You had to like him, that style, that grin, that record, those good intentions, but there was something exasperating and a tiny bit slimy about him. You can see I'm fixated on Ted. Why not? I'm still trying to figure him out. Sometimes it seems that everything that happened on that long morning is just something I imagined, or some half-baked writer's fantasy. But it did happen. And sometimes now it seems to me that Ted was at the center of it all, not me. It seems that Ted goaded them all into people they were not, or into the people they really were. All I know for sure is that Carol was looking at him defiantly, not like a demure valedictorian to be, due to speak on the problems of the black race. She looked angry and a wee bit cruel. When I think about the Eisenhower administration, I think about the U-2 incident. When I think about that funny morning, I think about the sweat patches that were slowly spreading under the arms of Ted's khaki shirt. When they drag him off, they won't find anything but nutcases, Ted was saying. He looked mistrustfully at Pigpen, who was glaring sweatily at the halves of his Bebop pencil as if they were the only things left in the world. His neck was grimy, but what the hell? Nobody was talking about his neck. They grind you down, he whispered. He threw the pencil halves on the floor. He looked at them, then looked up at me. His face was strange and grief-stunned. It made me uncomfortable. They'll grind you down too, Charlie. Wait and see if they don't. There was an uncomfortable silence in the room. I was holding onto the pistol very tightly. Without thinking about it much, I took out the box of shells and put three of them in, filling the magazine again. The hand grip was sweaty. I suddenly realized I had been holding it by the barrel, pointing it at myself, not looking at them. No one had made a break. Ted was sort of hunched over his desk, hands gripping the edge, but he hadn't moved except in his head. I suddenly thought that touching his skin would be like touching an alligator handbag. I wondered if Carol had ever kissed him, touched him, probably had. The thought made me want to puke. Susan Brooks suddenly burst into tears. Nobody looked at her. I looked at them, and they looked at me. I had been holding the pistol by the barrel. They knew it. They had seen it. I moved my feet, and one of them kicked Mrs. Underwood. I looked down at her. She had been wearing a casual tartan coat over a brown cashmere sweater. She was beginning to stiffen. Her skin probably felt like an alligator handbag. Rigor, you know. I had left a footmark on her sweater at some point in time. For some reason, that made me think of a picture I had once seen of Ernest Hemingway standing with one foot on a dead lion and a rifle in his hand and half a dozen grinning black bearers in the background. I suddenly needed to scream. I had taken her life. I had snuffed her, put a bullet in her head, and spilled out algebra. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.